So in the Midah of Binyamin, on the Choshen Mishpat, where every Shevet is given a stone, so the stone is the Yashpe. And Chazal, the Yashpe means Yesh Peh, that isn't used. So it's a reference to the mystery that is meant to provide. Remember, ambiguity is basically Schrodinger's box. In other words, that which provides the place for randomness is the fact that the results aren't in. The experiment hasn't been measured. Nobody knows precisely where it is that they're going. And in that sense, the Megillah is built around possibilities. It's all about possibilities. So that's what poor means.
The source of the, but it's from the same shortage as Hester.
Yeah, of course, sure. That which is hidden is that which is mysterious. Haita mastira dvareha, which of course relates to the underlying, as the Gemara says, Hester ponim, anochi haster astir. But the concept of Hester ponim is only not making it obvious. As Rashi says, ose et atzmo ki'ilu eni roi. It says, if I don't see. In other words, the hanhoga does not come to you. That's the inyan of nister, nais nister. So that the achievement and the end of the understanding of what life is all about is that it's always that way. That wherever anything needs to be put onto the surface, then you're in trouble. Because then you lose all of the real information. And you end up relating to something that is extremely superficial and really doesn't address, we'll see more of this as we go on. Obviously the theme of poor is going to be developed, but poor becomes, I mean, it's central to modern science. It's central to, you know, that obviously it's part of physics, but I'm saying, but even in the way that we always attempt to find underlying patterns that are not, we try to utilize statistics to pull apart interrelationships and not be fooled by what appear to be causal interrelationships. And that, of course, statistics are misused in that way. But those who attempt to get to the bottom of interactions never look for direct cause and effect. They look for statistical variations. They look for significance. And those significances can be in things that, to a person who isn't trained, it just looks like a bunch of useless data in which there's no particular pattern. So this is very, very much the entire Weltanschauung, one could say, of the world of Purim. So that a book about Purim is going to be a book that maintains ambiguity on every level. And that's because, as we saw before, the Machlokas, who is exactly Ahasuerus? What type of person is he? Melech Chacham or Melech Tipesh, or is he, as the Malbim says, one who is searching for the betterment of humanity? Or is he a vicious, rabid anti-Semite who is genocidal in the depths of his heart? The very fact that the book can be read with completely opposite readings of the characters on this level is absolutely astonishing, because that's exactly where you can have the level of poor. And we spoke before about how the Gemara brings out that that's really what it is that Esther ends up doing. But we'll get into that in the next parak, where we get to talk about what she's doing. And here, that ambiguity strongly expressed not only in the nature of these letters, because let's take a look. Here on the surface, what we have are letters that are supposedly going to make it clear that Nishlach Svenishlach Svarim Biyad Aratzim Kol Binyot HaMelech Lashmid Laharog Ulabed, to absolutely wipe out et Kol HaYehudim Minar VeHatzaken Taf VeNashim BiYom Echad B'Shlosha Asar LeChodesh Nimasar Hu Chodesh Adar Ushlalam Lavos. Now, that's very strange, because here it says that the letters contained the fact that these people are meant to be all wiped out in a very specific day, at a specific time, men, women, and children, and yet the very next line says, Patshegen haktav. Now, Patshegen, that's something that we saw a lot in Daniel. And it's interesting that here, the Medrash goes out of its way to say, what is Patshegen is antigraphon. Antigraphon. That's the word that's used in the Medrash. Now, antigraphon is Greek, and as the word implies, antigraphon. It means a Xerox copy. So that is the anti of the graphos that was there originally. So what it's saying is that the copies of the letter that were sent out didn't say anything of the sort. In fact, linatein dat b'chol medina u'medina galui l'chol ha'amim, that which was open to all of the people was merely liyot atidim liyom hazeh, to be prepared. Prepared for what? No idea. As the Medrash puts it, umot ha'olam nevuatan situma. I mean, liyot atidim liyom hazeh, enam yodim im laharog im lahareg. Be prepared for death, or be prepared for murder. Aval Yisrael nevuatan mifureshet. Same words, but it ends with a definition. And so, indeed, the attempt, now, what did this mean? Did it mean that, as far as was galui l'chol amim, as opposed to between the lines? Is that what it means? Perhaps. Some learn that way. In other words, the message that people were getting is, there's only one meaning to this kind of thing. It's fun day. Shoot the Jews up, boys.
Open season.
Open season. The kind of thing that you would have in, you know, rabidly anti-Semitic communities in the U.S. It's the same kind of thing. They got a letter like this. We know what it's all about, you know. But the Malbim here, too, has a fascinating approach. He says, look, there's clearly two letters. There's the letter that's Galui L'chol Amim. And then there's the letters that were sent out, which were Nichtav. V'nechtam b'tabat ha-melech. Nechtam b'tabat ha-melech doesn't mean the modern sense of Nechtam b'tabat ha-melech. Then on the bottom of the page it had this, the king's stamp. It means that the envelope was sealed, which it meant until very recently. The sealing ring was a sealing ring, which meant, says the Malbim, the instructions for the 13th of Adar came, do not open, as is very common, which is in all diplomatic missions, do not open until, it's very common. So that what he did was, he sent out two letters, levels of letters. He sent out one level where the people in the know would be able to start the propaganda against the Jews, to get people aware of the fact that the Jews are horrible and so on, have them connected in their own mind, you know. Or, according to their Malbim, they wouldn't really know until the moment came, and then, of course, you could always issue another letter, which would prevent them opening that letter and reading this letter. So that part of the letter wasn't binding. So all that was done was left open. And once it was sent, you can't return it. So you need to define it. Well, how are you going to define it if you don't want to kill the Jews? The only thing you could say is, for the Jews to kill. So basically, the Hapach was built in now to this. But again, it's the preservation of ambiguity that is so important in this story. Haratzim yatzu d'chufim bidvar ha-melech. And so the king has them sent out immediately. Vadat nitina b'shushan ha-bira. But of course, nobody knows what it means, as we see in the closing of the pasuk. V'amelach v'aman yashvu lishtot v'ayir shushan navocha. What do you mean, navocha? Navocha? Navocha means confused. What in the world is this all about? It's only in the next pasuk, which we begin the next so-called perek, u'mordechai yadat kol asher na'asa. So it's Mordechai who knows. We all kinds of, so how did Mordechai know? Whatever. Eliyahu HaNavi came to tell him, says the Medrash. Or says Rashi, the Bala Chalomot was Megalat. Well, whatever it is. I mean, obviously, on the political level, Mordechai is well connected and has all kinds of ways of knowing things. I mean, he was.
He read Tom Friedman's column in the New York Times. CIA
informant. Yes. Oh, please, Tom. In the middle of Esther, when we're learning about Haman, we got to remember Tom Friedman. Yeah. At the end, towards the end, is when we should remember. So, but clearly, ambiguity was the name of the game throughout this whole thing. Now, do you want to see to what amazing extent ambiguity is the name of the game? This is astounding. So the Talmidim, just think about it, Talmidim ask Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, they ask him, why was Klal Yisrael roy to be wiped out in this fashion? I mean, this was a real gezeira. And unfortunately, we've seen that gezeiras like this actually happen. They're not just games. What was this all about? What could have possibly justified this? So he says to them, you tell me. Very interesting remark. You tell me. So they say, well, it seems to follow along with the fact that they were nene misu'udato shela Torah shah. They went to the party, and whatever, yai nasach, no idea, no. So he says that if that's the case, only the locals should have been affected. Why was it a universal decree against all of the Jews? So they said, okay, so now you say. So he says, well, mipnei shishtachavu letzelem. Now, of course, this is going all the way back to Nebuchadnezzar, which is amazing. In other words, Mordechai is taking a stand. We have to understand what this means. I'll get to it in a moment, but he's taking a stand because of something that had happened. I mean, we're in the 10th year of Achashverosh. We have to go all the way back to before Koresh and before Belshazzar and get to the story of the crazy Misa with the Tselem that was, I mean, this is nuts. That was his vision that became so central in Dayovich's time. But that idea of, you know, we all have to bow down. Because of that, and amazingly, they didn't kill Mordechai. I mean, Lomaisa, the Gemara says, Mordechai is called a Yehudi, and Mordechai is called Yemini. Which one was it? So going to one shot in the Gemara. It's Klal Yisrael bemoaning the fact that this man exists. If only, look at what Yehudi did. Who was the Yehudi? Dovid HaMelech. He should have killed Shimi ben Gera on the spot. Mordechai is ben Shimi. So it's because he let Shimi survive that we have to deal with this nut who's going to get us all knocked off. And Ma'asali Yemini, why is he called Yemini? Because it's his Yemini, the Binyamin part, that allowed Agag to survive. Put Shimi and Agag together, and you get Mordechai and Haman just a few, 5 centuries later, and look what they've done to us. That's amazing. Yeah. Unbelievable. So, I mean, speaking of the historical flow, I mean, the historical awareness, it's just beautiful. So this is Klal Yisrael complaining, but that means that essentially they were actually responding to this kind of thing. I mean, Rav Dessler points out how, can you imagine when it is so clear, he compares it to the Holocaust issues, you know, where we're going, I mean, you know, the rabbis never know what they're talking about, they're getting us all killed off, and so on and so forth. Here's a guy that is clearly doing everything wrong to destroy Klal Yisrael, and telling them, instead of what is obvious, that he's being the umais against them, and he's a rebbe, and all the things that everybody sees are 100%, you have no right to do this, and he's telling them, no, you forgot, like 20 years ago, 15 years ago, did anybody say anything about that Tselem? That's what it's all about. And then when he gets them to do teshuvah, during these days now, during Tlanit Esther, they respond to him instead of killing him? That's an unbelievable thing that people should be able to accept a person like this. Of course, even at the end of the Megillah, he doesn't necessarily have all that many friends. He's Ratzui L'Rov Echav. Seems to be an awful lot of people are not too happy with him, as the Pasuk itself points out. But he's in a very delicate position himself. And indeed, Mordechai Yada, as the Mefarsha point out, and he realized it's all because of him. But this is what he was being choter to. Now, what's amazing is the closing of this discussion. So the Talmidim say to Reb Shimon Bar Yochai, look, I mean, the way we were learning, it's a gezeira, and you could be nitzo from this gezeira because it was a gezeira, it was a reaction to something that's a chiyuv mita. But according to the way you're explaining it, then when Mishtachavel it's selling, v'chimasu panim yesh b'davar. What do you mean? So God just, okay, fine. We're just playing a game. Now, note the words, masu panim. It's no se panim lecha. I'll forgive you, right? Amar lehem, he says to them, well, him lo asu ela lefanim. They just did it on face value. They didn't really mean it. Afakadosh baruch hu lo asayim ayana ela lefanim. He didn't really mean it. Shene mahayna dichtiv ki lo anam libo. He didn't plan this out in his heart. It was a game. That means that the entire story was ambiguous in the most profound way possible. The Gezeira in the Shemaim was ambiguous. And why is that? Because the Aveda of the Tselem was ambiguous. And therefore Mordechai's reaction was linked to that ambiguity, to the extent that Tesis has to explain. As we go back in the sugya about the Nebuchadnezzar statue itself. So the Rabbeinu Tam explains over there is that Tselem of Nebuchadnezzar, you will recall, is not truly Avodat Kochavim. It was a political statement. Political in the sense of Malchut. In other words, it was meant to be, you remember the scene, the orchestra that comprised the players from all over the world, the international symphony, and the moment that the symphony plays the absurd, constant refrain about, and as the drums and the violins and the cymbals, so on and so forth, right? Remember that? And everybody has to bow down and so on. But it just seemed, I mean, it was the same tones that you get here in Megillas Esther. It was the background to this Gilbert and Sullivan play. Exactly the same tones. And nonetheless, says the Rabbeinu Tam, so it was L'chvod HaMelech, okay? And therefore, it's really true that Hananiah Mishael V'Azariah, the godless of Hananiah Mishael V'Azariah, that they weren't Mishtachavel Tzelem, was that it was completely Lifnim Mishurat Adin. They were allowed to be Mishtachavel to this Tzelem from a purely political point of view if the Melech is standing there and it's having them to do it. And yet, he says, that explains why the Gemara says that had Hananiah Mishael V'Azariah been tortured, they would have bowed down to this Tzelem. Says Tosfos, I mean, that's crazy. That's been throughout the generations. So many people have stood up to torture, not to bow down to Avodah Zarah. Well, Hananiah Mishael V'Azariah, Dafka were only able not to be Mishtachaver because it was only death, not physical torture. And Reb Hananiah ben Taradion was wrapped in a Sefer Torah, wouldn't get in, and burned alive. What's the Chiddush over here? So clearly it must be that it wasn't really Avodat Kochavim. And that's even if you listen to what Hananiah Mishael V'Azariah tell Nebuchadnezzar, is they say to him, Le'elohach let anan palchim. We don't worship your God. And Le'tzalmech let anan segidim. We refuse to bow down to your statues. Clearly, says Tosfos, mashma d'tray miliyav. These were two separate issues. What that means is that when we're talking about Yehudi being called Yehudi because he's kofer b'avodat kochavim, or because he's Yechidi, and it says he's miyached shmo shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu ba'olam, what he was doing was indeed entirely shelo kefi, what was required la'aloch. But the entire thing was built around the devastation of relying on the halach. That's exactly what Rav Shimon HaYochai is saying. There is a time in which the context of things becomes so definitive that although it's secular, the secular becomes a religion. And if you'll notice, Purim is a completely secular holiday. Because of this, the point is that it's meant to deal with the interrelationship of the panim, the ponim that are on things, the facade, literally the face on things, and what is happening inside. Mordechai recognized that it was the bowing down to that tzelem that remarkably, as Rav Shimon Bar Yochai pointed out, was the equivalent in the realistic effects of what it would do to Klal Yisrael, was the equivalent of Avodah Zarah. Why does this happen? becomes clear only, and I'm going to jump ahead because we need to see that next pasuk. In Mordechai Yada, we've already spoken about the first part. Vayikra Mordechai et Begada vayibash sak vayefer. Vayetse betoch ha'ir vayizak zeaka gedola umara. Now that vayizak zeaka gedola umara, Chazal remarkably show us that the place where it says this, or the only other place, is Esav. He comes out of that room, into that room, as Yaakov left, Vayitzak Tzaka Gidola Umara. And Paralo B'Shushan, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, paid Yaakov back in Shushan, Sheneamar Zaka Gidola, Vayitzak Tzaka Gidola Umara, exactly the same language. Lolam Decha She'in Vatranut, Lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Everything counts. Now what counts here? What counts? The Vayizak Zaka Gedola Umara was exactly the issue that fooled everybody about the Nazis. Because the reason that there was no reaction to the Nazis, even though they were publicly proclaiming, they were not ambiguous, their intent to destroy Israel, was because every time that had happened, you could buy your way out. And it was for that reason that Jews, in fact, provided the financial backing for Hitler, because that's always the way in which you gain influence. The amazing thing about the Nazis is they couldn't be bought. And that's exactly what this Megillah is about. That's why money is so important. The entire relationship between Yaakov and Esav is built around money. As the Gemara says, it's all about bribes. So that at the very first moment that Yaakov comes back to Esav, it's all about sending him money. And then he's happy. As long as I'll make money off of it, I don't need to stand for anything. But Vayizak Zaka Gedola Umara is the one thing that I care about. It was that care that created Amalek. Everything else, multiculturalism, okay, we got room even for Jews. Postmodernism will even tolerate your religion. But this, the Zakah Gedola Umara, means that it becomes now a religion to destroy those who search for meaning. A religion to destroy Yisrael. It's because of that, you'll recall, that the birth of Amalek requires the act of Mesiras Nefesh of Amalek's mother as well. And this the Timna Haitapilegesh Lelifaz Benesav. How did that Amalek? How did that happen? Because she wanted very much to be Jewish. And she wanted so much to be Jewish that when Avram and Yitzchak refused to accept her, she said she was Achot Lotan Timna. That's one of the amazing Gemaras that say Lodavar Reik Hu Michem, which of course is the last missing piece of the carry, Yerek, Yakar, and Reik. So the Lo Davar Reiku Michem refers to what pasuk, says the Gemara? The weirdest thing. Refers to a pasuk of Timna Haita Pilegesh, of Achot Lotan Timna. And this is the joke. The Torah has to tell us the name of the sister of some strange tribal chieftain. I mean, who cares? It's obviously reik, meaningless. The Torah talks about nonsense. Fine, says the Gemara. But now that you mention it, what is the meaning of that? The Gemara. I mean, since it's Atit L'Yada, you've brought it up. What does it mean?
It sounds ambiguous.
Yeah, exactly. So what indeed does it mean? Says the Gemara, it means the most amazing thing. It means that we need to know where she was coming from. So if Timna, the information we have of Timna is that she ends up becoming a mistress? But who was she? A princess. Achot Lotan Timna. And Lotan is one of the leaders of his country. So how in the world did she end up as a mistress in a house without any kind of status? Ah, that's why it's essential that you understand this, says the Gemara. She clearly had been rejected and was not accepted into Klal Yisrael. Therefore, she said, look, I would rather be a mistress with the lowest in this house than be a princess in my own world. So she became now a Pilegish to Eliphaz. So as my Rebbe used to always say, Chaim Shtutzner, you need that kind of mesiras nefesh to get Amalek. Right? And that's exactly both sides of the equation. The v'yizak zakag d'ala umara has to be coupled with passion. That's passion. And yet, I mean, so mamela, it's no gea what's happening over here. I understand it's no gea that this was the thing in which the reality is that they have this kayak. But to say that l'lamdacha she'in vatranut l'kadosh baruch hu, this is a payback, it's a punishment, it's meaningful. What does it mean? And here is the meaning. It's mamish, an amazing thing. It relates, and that's why it comes right here as the conclusion of this particular element. What it means is this. The Vayizak Zakag Dala Umara is only meaningful in Esav terms because there was something that he really wanted that was related to something that Yaakov took. Correct? In other words, if it hadn't been that Yaakov had walked away with something that was really shayach to Esav, then there wouldn't have been any Vayizak Zakag Dala Umara. What it was that Yaakov was doing was taking advantage of Esav's own hatred, which comes up here again, Vayivez Beinav, as the Medrash points out. This Vayivez Beinav is the Vayivez Esav et HaBechora. Comes from that same sense, not wanting to have anything to do with Kiddushah. So he was Mevazer, as Rashi says, Malamet Shebiza Avodat Hashem Mekom. So then what was he screaming about? Clearly, he saw in Yaakov, just as we see later in the meeting of Yaakov and Esav, where he sends him all these gifts, and as the Medrash points out, so Esav says, but I thought that the whole idea was that you were going to have Olam Haba, and I was going to have Olam Hazeh, and now you seem to be pretty darn rich. And Yaakov Avinu says, yeah, but those riches are only things that I use to get to Olam Haba. And Esav says, well, that's okay. I'd be rich just to use things to get Olam Haba too. That would be lovely. You mean you get the best of both worlds and you're claiming that this is a problem? That's exactly what happened over here. Rashi, listen to this. This is amazing. Rashi, it's a machlokas in the Gemara, right? I mean, these are the Talmidim of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai versus Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, who shows them it can't be because of the party. It has to be shishtachavu letzalim, right? Take a look in Rashi, and Rashi says Umordechai yada. What does Umordechai yada mean? Baal hachalom amarlo. He was told in a dream that hiskimu elyonim lakach, that the Beit Din Shamala has agreed to the gezerah against the Jews. Why? Lefishi ishtachavu letzelem b'mei Nebuchadnezzar v'ne'enu misudat HaChashverosh. What? Speaking of ambiguity and keeping your options open, what? Unbelievable. So, this is mamish the pshat. He is omed on the underlying nekuda of the meaning of this ambiguity. You really tread a very thin line when you tell Esav that, but this is not mine in Olam Hazeh terms. Says Reb Shimon bar Yochai, Hem lo asu ela lefanim. But what is that lefanim? That they pretended to be mishtachav et ritzalim? It's much more than that. It's that the impact of that tzalim is a secular idea. It was a secular malchus. A secular tzalim. A secular idolatry. That secular idolatry that ends up with a secular holiday that has no mention of God and no elements in it that you would recognize Yisrael masquerading, which is, of course, Lifanim, why it's so central to the whole expression of Purim. It's only the covering of your face. And you say, that is insignificant. It's really what's in my heart that counts. And that's the entire idea of the Megillah. Mordechai is trying to prove There cannot be, on any level, a buying into the standards, the culture, the belief system of something which is utterly meaningless and alien and pretending that it matters. So you say you went to the party. Did you enjoy the party? Yeah. You enjoyed Nenu Misudato Shalotarata. You enjoyed the party. Why didn't you vomit at the party? Why didn't you say these people are so empty, they're so nauseating, that it is absolute torture to be here? Because you found something in there that you could adjust to. That's the whole nature of the Galut. That's exactly the point. We can remain completely Jewish and still live within this milieu. Says Mordechai, that's not true. That is simply not true. You can use that milieu. But don't enjoy the party. That's not the point at all. And therefore, Rashi says, that was the gili, the nenu, and the party was the gili of the meaning of the tzelem. Comes along now, Mordechai, and does his shoe shtick. Why? Why aren't you bowing down? Because I'm Jewish. So? Your great-grandfather bowed down to my great-grandfather. Yaakov bowed down to Esav. So, exactly. Huh? So Yaakov bowed down to Esav. Says Mordechai, well, I'm from Binyamin. You know, I'm from Missouri. You know, proven. You know. Binyamin never bowed down. That was the point. He wasn't born yet. He wasn't born yet. So we've developed a little bit since then. And I'm smarter. Because we've seen what just pretending does. You can't live with pretense when it defines your entire milieu. That's the idea. And therefore he goes out of his way to do things that other people think are crazy, because they really are. Because obviously Haman is an Avodah Zarah on the level that the Tzelem is an Avodah Zarah. He's a political Avodah Zarah. The divine rights of kings and the appointees of kings and so on, who cares? Does anybody really believe this? It's a symbolism. It's the idea of the value and the power and the grandeur of Parah. So what's the big deal? And here, for the first time, we recognize the level of ambiguity that allows for possibilities, which provides us with the potential for utilizing Pur, for being Zoche to Neis Nister. All of that is locked into how you experience that reality. If you experience it as a facade, and you live within the facade, Lefanim, if you don't break through the facade, HaKadosh Baruch Hu could treat you to the facade of murder. But if you break through, Heim lo asu ela lefanim, af HaKadosh Baruch Hu lo asu ela lefanim. And therefore the multi-level, the pnim and the chutz, the underlying issues and the face, the farce that this is all about from beginning to end, begins at last to start to gel into a serious way of examining the way in which you relate to the world overall. To the extent that you buy into something that you know is nothing but a facade, to that extent you live in an Newtonian universe. It's all about mechanics. Mechanics is a facade. The direct, simple ideas of cause and effect, religious ideas, miraculous ideas, are all facades. They don't really mean anything. They're ways in which primitive humans experience reality, because it's easiest that way, to believe in it. Knowing all along something is wrong, it couldn't really be like this. And so it's this perek specifically that provides the transitional moment in which, in the next perek we're going to see, we openly discuss the nature of how one behaves in a universe that is governed by chance, and that is its most profound expression of the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, not what you confuse with the hiding of the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And it's here. That's why this pasuk that opens up the next is so linked. It's a stuma here, even though it seems to be a new. It's a stuma. It's not a ptucha, this particular parsh that opens up what the Goyim call the fourth parak. And as we open it, we need to have access to this ending and this transition.
So this is divided as well by the
no, yes, of course.
It's not a
It's not a function of the actual the way it was written.
Correct. I mean, there are simonim of the parshas which exists here, but not as a main, not as a ptucha in this case here. Yeah.